What is phase two?
New day is dawning. The day of the
Power Cosmic Podcast.
Gathered from around the galaxy comes the world's greatest comic book fans, all in one terrific podcast. It's the
Power Cosmic Podcast.
With your host with the most, the man who puts on Terrific Con, the world's greatest Comic Con every August at the Mohegan Sun in Uncasville, Connecticut, Mitch Halleck. Joining Mitch each week will be an assembly of his terrific super friends. Join them as they talk about comic books, movies, and more. It's the Power Cosmic Podcast.
Power Cosmic Podcast.
Hey everybody, how are you? It is your old buddy Mitch here, producer of Terrific Con, and I'm hard at work at this year's show. If you've been following us on social media, you know by the time you're listening to this that the one, the only, the Elvis of comics, Steranko, Jim Steranko, is coming to Terrific Con on August 9th to the 11th at the Mohegan Sun. And Jim will be bringing, for the first time ever in New England, rare original artwork that will be on display. And where will you see this? You're not going to see it at New York Comic Con. No, you're not going to see it at Boston or anywhere else. But you are going to see it at Terrific Con, Connecticut's Terrific Comic Con at Mohegan Sun. Isn't that cool? Steranko. Man, the guy is like, if you listen to past episodes of the Power Cosmic, we went on about him for about an hour one day. It's the man, the myth, the legend. It all applies. Comic book historian, comic book artist, writer, magician, publisher. He revolutionized the graphic looks of comics when he came onto the circuit in the 60s. It's just something. He's just one of those guys that is a whirlwind. He came in and just changed the way people looked at books. But anyway, Jim Steranko will be there. And cat's out of the bag. I was kind of holding off on this one. But Mr. George Perez is making good on a promise that he had 2 years ago when he was going to appear at Terrific Con, but unfortunately he suffered two heart attacks and was not able to come that year. So he said, I will make up for it. I will come back. Bittersweet, George announced his retirement from comic books on Friday. He will no longer be drawing or writing comic books. He's done a great job. It's been a fantastic career. And everybody grew up with him. I mean, I did. I remember reading him in the Avengers. I remember reading him in Man-Wolf comics and Marvel Premiere. And then I went over to DC with the New Teen Titans, Wonder Woman, Infinity Crisis on Infinite Earths. How could you forget that? I mean, it's just been one amazing story after another. So, true to his word, he is going to fly and be with us for one day only, Friday, August 9th, because he also promised another convention that he would be with them down in Florida on August 10th and 11th. So give it up for Mr. Perez for being a man of his word. He's going to come up here to our show, meet fans. We're going to open early. I'm going to have some details about that because I know the turnout's going to be amazing. He's going to stay right till 8 o'clock, and then he's going to go on an airplane and fly down to his next convention. And that, my friends, will be George Perez's final appearance at Terrific Con, because he's also winding down his Comic-Con appearances as well. So make sure you get out there if you're going to see George Perez. Bring your book. He signs for free. He will not be sketching at the show. He will be doing five or six sketches for some lucky fan. You have to apply for it 30 days before the show. So, you know, again, keep watching the website. I'll have links up there for that. Again, this is George Perez. He's done a mountain of work, and he's earned a fantastic retirement, and we wish him all the best. So please come out and see that. So today's Power Cosmic is a mishmash. It's a grab bag, if you will. I've been drawing a lot lately. I went to school for that. I was a commercial artist. I was a graphic designer, art director, creative director, marketing director. I've done a lot of things in my life. And I originally wanted to be a comic book artist. And I went to Marvel Comics, got offered a job. I turned it down. It wasn't enough money. Then I went to DC. Another story. But I really kind of stopped drawing right around then. Once I didn't get these jobs, I just kind of focused on doing graphic design and advertising. So I didn't go back to drawing comic book stuff. So it's been, what is that, 96 to now, like 22 years, 23 years, something like that. So I started drawing when Stan Lee passed away. I just did a real quick sketch, and everyone seemed to like it. And then I said, you know what? What has changed since I've done this in the past? And they have these new Copic markers and, you know, watercolor brushes and all this stuff that they really didn't have when I was younger. So I started fooling around with it and talking to my pal Jerry Ordway on how he does it. And he gave me some pointers and how he does these sketch covers. And then I buy sketch covers for the show, Terrificon, and I usually sell them at my booth for people that want to get sketches from the artist. So I have a pile of them here at the house. So I just started drawing whatever the title was. If it was an Ant-Man book that had a sketch cover, I drew an Ant-Man. If it was, you know, the Hulk, I drew a Hulk or something like that. But I've been trying to do one, almost one a day, or, you know, at least one a week if I can get to it now that the show's starting up, because I got GamerCon too. But you will see them on Facebook. I post them in the page, and sometimes they tie into whatever guests we have coming to the show. So it's kind of like a sneak peek. Speaking of sneak peeks, you're going to hear also in this episode, I talk about several of the guests for Terrificon. See, that's why it's fun to listen to the Power Cosmic. You get kind of a sneak preview of what's going to happen. And I talk about some of the actors I've been engaged with lately, some of the conversations we're having. And Jerry lets me in on some behind-the-scenes secrets, because we're talking about Batman 89 and some of the things that most people don't know, because Jerry worked on the comic adaptation, got to go to London, got to take pictures of the set and all that stuff. So he has stories that you don't know about when it came to making the Michael Keaton, Jack Nicholson movie. So all that's in this power-packed episode of The Power Cosmic. It's a good 45-minute random ramblings between the two of us. Next time you hear it, we're going to talk about the new Superman animated film, The Reign of the Superman, which is a sequel to The Death of Superman that Jerry had a hand in. And if all goes well, we will be talking to you from the premiere of the movie. We're going to New York. We've already seen it. It's on digital as well. But we have the opportunity to go to the New York red carpet premiere and chat with the stars, Jerry O'Connell, Rebecca Romijn, O'Connell, I guess, and a bunch of other people. So we will find out what happens. So you'll see that maybe in about 2 weeks, because the premiere is next Monday. So sit back, put your headphones on, go for a walk, drive your car, put it on in the background. I don't care what you do. And listen to another episode of the Power Cosmic Podcast.
I want the Colony Grill one.
All right, so we're talking about coloring,
which
I made.
Covers.
Remember a couple years ago at the start, they had those coloring books?
Right.
I was making fun of people, the adult coloring books. Right, I was like, what is this? What am I, 5 years old? Right. Adult coloring books? Because it was supposed to be relaxing.
Right.
And it is, actually. But at the time, I thought it was very, like, condescending. Like, you're 50, 60, 70 years old, and they're giving you a Crayolas. It's like, what am I, like, in a diaper? In a nursing home?
With Crayolas.
No. But I've been watching you, and I see, ever since, when did they first start doing the sketch cover books? Was it a response to conventions when people wanted those? I mean,
somebody
came up with this. It's a great idea.
Yeah, it'd be good to find out. But the first ones were just basically colored, unprinted, with just a logo.
With the masthead, or the trade dress.
Right. Say, coated stock, which was really horrible.
It's really bad to work with. Yeah,
you could use a Sharpie on it.
Yeah.
But you couldn't use anything else.
So, originally, I'm thinking it was a convention thing for sketch covers. Just black sketch covers.
I bet it was Sharpies. The first time I encountered them. And
like
this
5 years ago?
It was must have been 2012, maybe, when I did the Archie Comics for...
You think so? That long ago?
Yeah, the 2012,
well,
I think.
Well, it's 2019, so you're saying 7 years ago they started doing
this?
The
one that I did for Archie was for the it was for the charity, for the comic...
I'm watching. It's going. No, I'm just, I didn't see. We're not talking that loud, but we're talking.
No, it was for, you know, the comic book charity. They did the Archie thing, and then they did the collection.
What, the Hare Initiative?
Yeah, they did the book collecting all of them, but they sold the individual
right.
ones.
Oh no,
off.
Those have been around. You'd buy the book and you go to store
right,
shop.
But that was
or
those were
conventions.
The first ones that I remember encountering.
But that was mostly for a black Sharpie.
No, those were actually pretty good.
Really?
I think of it because those were heavier stock.
Hmm.
And they did Archie. They did, I know they did other ones that I didn't work on, but I did, I've done most of them. They did a Marvel one. They did, you know, X-Men, Fantastic Four. They did Wonder Woman. They did,
I
and they've done them
these.
As auctions, and then they create a book that the book is then sold, and the proceeds go to the charity as
I
well.
First started seeing these when Mid-Ohio Con.
Okay.
Would start to do their programs, and on the back cover they would leave it blank
yeah,
with their
that's
logo.
Yeah, that's probably the same.
Yeah, so yeah. You could go around to the yeah. artist and get a sketch there. Yeah. It was like, that was a cute idea. But the companies, yeah. Marvel and DC...
That makes sense that they started that when they started doing the variant covers again.
Yeah, the blank variants, yeah.
The variants fell out of fashion, and then they came back in.
Well, sometimes you would get it,
years.
And it went... sometimes you get the normal cover.
Right.
And then they put a white cardboard on top. But for a while, it wasn't right. that. It was just, well, I sneezed. That well, some, was your cover.
Sometimes they were just bad. Like, the paper quality
but
was pretty bad.
I got some old ones from Midtown because right. they were on sale. I was like, oh, let me get some sketch covers.
Right.
No. They're IDW right. books. They're like ROM, Micronauts. Right. And the coating is so slick. It goes right off of
yeah.
it. It's
well,
like you can't put the markers on it. They don't dry.
Right. The one that I told you was a problem for me was the Secret Invasion. Was
yeah.
It was a Captain America. It's like Secret
Invasion. Yeah. Was Secret Invasion. Yeah. The Skrulls. Yeah.
And that one had like a inset square panel
right.
that was white that you could draw on.
Right. Drawing's fine.
One,
black.
No, but that one also, that was one that required you to use pretty much a Sharpie because... regular ink wouldn't dry
yeah.
because it was coated.
Oh,
it
would smear.
Yeah, it was coated.
I've had
stuff.
That too sometimes. Like my fingers rub
but
against
just,
it and it just ruins
you
it.
You would have to like set them aside for literally for a day before you did anything.
Yeah.
But then you couldn't put color on top of them because color would dissolve because nothing absorbs into the paper. It was
no,
just sitting
no, no,
on
no.
top.
But and then now there's all markers. The Copic markers, when did that really become a big thing? Because when I was a kid, you had Beryl, B-E-R-O-L, which were really smelly.
Design
and then
markers.
Prisma, yeah,
well,
design, and then
design
Prisma Color, which was the fat side and the thin side.
Yeah, but the Copics remind me of design markers.
Yeah,
they're just not as
with the two ends of it, the chisel tip, and then
well, the designs we just had. Yeah, you buy separate markers.
Right.
One was a fine point, and
oh,
one
yeah,
was
yeah.
a chisel tip, and that's what we use for doing like layout comps and stuff. And
but they weren't that
commercial art.
They weren't that dark, like the opaqueness.
They were pretty intense. You could get, but you had, we used to work on, there was a specific kind of marker paper
yeah.
that we would do layout comps on. There
yep.
were, it was like a semi,
was, yeah,
you
I
could
had
see
that.
Through it.
It was,
so
it was
almost,
called marker comp paper.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it had a coating that basically kept that marker from totally absorbing through. No, no,
nope.
but it was just, it was some kind of coating.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you could use design markers on, say, Strathmore and they would bleed.
Yep.
You'd put the line down, and they would keep like for weeks
yeah, yeah,
afterwards.
See the ink. Yeah,
the solvent would seep into the edges. So
yeah,
yeah,
yeah. it was fuzzy. Yeah, yeah.
The Copics don't do that.
No,
they're probably because they have a different kind of solvent. It probably dissipates faster, which you could tell when you're working on them.
Yeah,
you have to work fast because it does dry fast.
Oh no, I trust me. I'm going
so
back, and I'm
blend.
Like trying to. It won't
the
work.
The design markers you could do a lot of blends.
Oh, you
with.
Could blend those forever.
Right, right.
I used to do that.
So that's the. I would say the paper has gotten good in the last 3 years where they're actually putting some form of Strathmore or some kind of drawing paper on them.
Yeah, but do you look at... So you said you just did one for Green Lantern. You just did... What was the one you did it to Soulflex?
I did the Shazam one.
Shazam
before,
one,
right.
right. So that one there, you're doing those at home, but you really don't have time at a convention.
No, I don't bring color markers, no.
No, because you could do a black and white, and that's
yeah.
about it. This is
and
a,
when I do
a commission,
for,
really.
But when I do them for eBay, like, I can get $500 for them.
Yeah.
And that's
yeah.
worth my while to do
right,
color.
Right,
but
right.
if I was, you know, I wouldn't even do them regularly. They're just more, it's, for me, it's fun to work in color.
The only problem with color is, once you screw that up, you're done. Because
yeah.
I do that, I get the,
oh,
I
yeah.
saw you were taking, you had a scrap paper.
to see what colors was which, because I don't trust it either. I go, oh, this is a light blue. And then I go to put it down, and it's a dark blue, and you're like, oh, great, I have this whole wide open area with this big smudge. And you can't cover it up with that white, because you can't then color over that stuff. It's like a paint.
Right. But that's part of doing a sketch at a show, too, is that you don't know how it's going to work. A mistake.
No. You know what I mean? You got one shot.
You're not going to, the guy, whoever's buying it is not going to want like a big blob of white out on it.
Do you rather do commissions at home or do at a show?
They're different.
You really are?
Like at a show.
You're trying to bang it out in an hour?
Well, yeah. At a show, it's about doing something quickly in front of somebody and having it still come out well.
Yeah.
But when you're at home, you can kind of hem and haw and you wind up taking too much time on it, but you also want it to be perfect.
Yeah.
Like when I do a commission, I don't want to have white out or mistakes. So if I'm inking something and I screw it up, I have to start over.
What did you do years ago before they had the internet and somebody asked you for a sketch and a character? You had no idea what the costume looked like. Because that happened to me.
Someone would have to bring a comic to show you.
But they think you know it all. They're like, don't you have a file in your head where you know every costume variation?
And that happened at... I remember
a guy wanted Commander Steel from you, one of my cop friends.
Yeah.
And he goes, oh, Jerry's going to be there, and there was a character in All-Star.
Right. He's got a complicated costume.
Yeah, but that's the one that's on the Legends of Superheroes, right?
Yeah, but his costume has got, he's got like striping down
his
sleeves.
Yeah, it's like a Captain America
that goes into his glove, and he's got...
It's red one. He's got a weird helmet with a fin on it. Yeah.
Right, it's complicated.
Just draw it.
You just don't remember it exactly. Like, I mean, you could draw it, but it would be like, you know, wait, I'm doing a sketch of somebody who just robbed me.
Did he have brown hair?
Did he have, you know what I mean?
So now you have the internet. You could just call it up on your phone and go, oh, that's what the costume was.
Yeah, well, the one at the New York Con a couple of years ago, I had somebody, and I hadn't been sketching for like 20 years. I had not done any sketching. And I started sketching at that New York Special Edition show.
You were at that one?
Yeah. And somebody said they wanted a Doomsday. And it was on a blank cover, now that I think of it, too.
Oh, no.
So it was a Doomsday. And I'm like, you know, I never really drew Doomsday. I was writing the book when we did that. So I didn't have that in my head at all.
But he has those bones coming out of
his
thing.
And the guy couldn't come up with something. So I started trying to come up with it the way I remembered it. It was like, yeah, that doesn't look right. I tried to save it, but... Ultimately, you need reference.
Well, no, that look changed, too, because he had the green costume
when
he landed, and then he started to evolve.
That's what I should have done.
You should have done it with the goggles. And then his body started to mutate and stuff. No, but I had the guy the other day said there was a character in Venom comic books called Toxin, and I knew Carnage was the red Venom.
Right.
Black is Venom. Then there's another yellow girl with a purple hair. I don't know.
Vinny.
I don't know. So the guy goes, oh, I want you to draw Toxin.
Right.
So I do a Google search for the image, and there's three different costumes. One's black with red. One's all red. I'm like, which one do you want? He goes, the first one. What the hell's the first one?
Right.
So I have to go look it up.
You just have them supply.
I don't know them all. Really?
Yeah.
Because all
if you want something specific, please supply me with the reference.
And I would have known what he's talking about.
Yeah, no, you...
Because I drew it based on all the different versions. I kind of made them, molded them together. And then he goes, oh, well, that's kind of like the first version and the third version because it had tentacles. Right. He goes, it's fine. I go, dude,
well, but
you know, you're not paying me right now.
That happens at shows when somebody says, we want, even a Golden Age Green Lantern.
Yeah.
Do you want the Golden Age Green Lantern from the 40s?
Alan Scott.
In the 40s, he had... No, I mean, in the 40s, he had a loose shirt with, like, wrinkles.
Like a pirate shirt.
It was a collar shirt.
Yeah.
In the 60s and 70s, he had a tight-fitting superhero-type costume.
Okay.
He didn't have the baggy shirt.
All right.
So there's differences, and you always... I always have to ask people, specify, like...
Hawkman, you know the difference between Hawkman?
Hawkman's had five different colors.
I know. Somebody asked me... Barry Kitson drew Hawkman on the cover. And I had to color it, but I didn't know that there was different color wings because he's got gray wings in the 40s and brown wings in the 60s.
Right, they're more bird-like in the 60s version.
And then his helmet changed. Yeah.
But in the 40s version, his helmet changed multiple times as well.
It depends on who's drawing
it. He had a mask towards the end in the 50s. He had a mask. And then in the Joe Kubert era, he had the one we did in All-Star Squadron, which had a full beak.
Yeah.
It had a top and lower, you know, the full beak.
Yeah.
And then there was just the original one just had the top part of the beak. So there's a lot of choice.
You'd be surprised.
We did a funny, that's one thing I give, like Roy Thomas was had fun with it.
He told you which one he wanted?
In All-Star Squadron, well, he liked the Joe Kubert version the best because that was his childhood favorite. But we had a scene where I think it was either Hawkman or Hawk Girl was getting the costume on.
Yeah.
And he specifically asked for all of the different costume
like a wardrobe?
Right, they were like on little head mannequins. It's like which
I'll
one
pick
to choose.
That one today.
Which was kind of fun because that it basically acknowledges those all were real or continuity.
So what's the hardest one to draw? If somebody comes up to you in this show and says, can you draw me Ben Grimm?
Oh, no. He's not that. He's.
I said there, I found out there's a trick to Ben Grimm.
Yeah, there is.
At first you go, all those rocks, but Mark Bagley told me, we were in the car, he drew me one in the car. He said, once you find out like the direction they're going, like it's almost like the muscles are going this way.
Yeah.
That's which way you do it,
right,
and then you just block it off. Yeah.
But they're also...
I had no idea.
They're not too perfect, and they're never the same. The
I
face can be
out.
Consistent. Joe Sinnott, yeah. Joe Sinnott
with
created
that... eyebrow, that unibrow.
Right, but Joe Sinnott did the best in, like, basically making the Kirby one consistent and inking anybody over the years. It always looked like the thing because he had the right feel. You can't put too many... rocks on.
Don't make them too small.
Because like Starlin did that when he first did.
Oh God, yeah,
it was
they
like
were
too
like,
many. Small
it looked like
rocks.
A mosaic. I was like, what is that?
But
Byrne doing it.
And Byrne had a theory body shape which was interesting because his theory was that the thing was shaped like a starfish, as opposed to other people would draw him like he had an argument. I know
Patrick.
Specifically he had an argument with Paul Ryan over the fact that Paul thought of the thing basically as rocks on a gorilla body.
Yeah.
And John's theory makes more sense. You know, but again...
Which thing? Both, the lumpy one from the original?
No, more of a starfish. He's like he's got basically 5 points.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, a little head,
right.
Arms, yeah.
That was his theory on the construction of the character. He wasn't really that humanoid. He was more monster-like. So you see it both ways, but that's open to interpretation.
Yeah,
you know?
But that's the problem. Some guys start drawing it like a big
weightlifter
guy.
Now he looks too much like a human, and it doesn't look like the thing. Like when you see the painted covers that were on the recent Fantastic Four.
Yeah, when we got married.
He's a little bit too... He's got too much anatomy.
Yeah.
He really shouldn't have anatomy. He should just be a shape.
Yeah. I never noticed that.
But the hardest characters to draw, invariably, if someone asks you to draw something that George Perez had designed, they're the hardest because George would throw
like the
in
Nightwing.
Everything.
You ever see that Nightwing costume? They call it the disco shirt. It's got all those like
right, but that's
things.
Not even. It's not a slam at George. It's just the idea.
The detail.
Like George would throw in chainmail with scale mail with belts and there
well,
was like
the Taskmaster.
It was like everything in the kitchen sink. These characters had like. Just so much accessory that you couldn't remember it all from,
Deathstroke was another one for the
crazy.
Teen Titans. Deathstroke's got belt, got the thing.
I mean, they look
a pirate's hat.
And they look cool. They look cool in the art.
Like a pinup, yeah.
They
but
look
panel
cool.
to panel. It must
but,
be insane.
But unless you drew that character, you wouldn't memorize it. There's no way you could, commit it to memory.
No, you know. All the Asgardians, I always thought that too.
I saw, it's actually funny to think of it. I saw my daughter Rachel and I watched the Lego Batman.
Yep.
And there's like one brief scene with Tarantula. It's like a bunch of Batman villains with the Joker at the beginning.
Yeah.
And I said, wait, pause that.
No,
let's go back to it. Because Tarantula was the character that I redesigned when I did All-Star Squadron. He was just,
I'm thinking the Marvel one.
Yeah, no, the DC one was, he looked like the Sandman from the
40s. Outfit,
he just had yellow and purple.
Right.
He had like, yellow costume, purple gloves, purple pants, purple boots, purple helm, mask. So we made him look more spider, gave him a spider thing, and he was brown.
Yeah.
That was a big thing, brown and black. And then I guess Chuck Dixon created a female version.
I don't know.
Or had a female version when he was doing Nightwing in the 90s, I think. So that's apparently what was in the... But it was pretty much based on my costume, so I was like,
oh, that was
cool.
In there?
Yeah. But I mean, that character is another one that if I had to draw it, even though I created it and designed it, I would still kind of go, wait, did he have...
Yeah.
What kind of boots did he have? Because sometimes you can't keep
it
on
your
head.
Oh, no, you forget. No. Hawkeye's a weird costume.
Hawkeye, never drew him from fan days, I drew him. But I had 3 sketches in the last 2 years and I've never with done the old before costume? That. And, yeah, and it's like, whoa.
Oh, no. That mask has never made sense.
It's kind of cool. Pointy one. I mean, I feel it's cool when you do it because it's touching on stuff I read when I was a kid.
Yeah, yeah, but he's got a chainmail undershirt. You got the vest on. He's got the
right.
Quill.
He's got the quiver going across. Right. Slash, you know, yeah. Kind of but belt. The,
he's got Scarlet the, Witch and him have the weirdest.
Right. Well, they're what like are those? they're like little points. Yeah. It's kind of the same mask. When you think about it, it's the also, same mask that they had on. Was it Black Cat? And also, Catwoman in the '50s. It's that really big pointy.
Oh yeah, you know, yeah, I mean, yeah. Eartha Kitt when she was on Batman '66.
But I mean, in the comics, she wore that big pointy one. Right, it was the big pointy thing.
No, I don't know. It's like
those
it's,
characters were probably. I don't know if those were even Kirby designs. They could be, but
what do you mean, Catwoman?
No. Oh, Hawkeye.
Oh, that was Black Don Widow. Heck, wasn't it?
But Kirby did a lot of covers, and he would design characters by doing.
He
the
first
cover.
Shows up in Iron Man.
But I'm saying, if it had a Kirby cover, then Kirby probably designed him.
And then said, here you go.
Because that's how Stan would have Kirby do the cover, and then if a new villain was on, Kirby had to do the design for the villain.
Oh.
And then the artist followed that.
No, I just was like trying to draw that. So the other thing is, you prefer just doing the black and white, or do you like coloring it now? Because you inked and drew, but now you're doing these marker pumps.
I was going through stuff when I worked in commercial art. I like coloring.
Yeah, but that's not the same way nowadays. Back then it was all screens and a CYMK.
Well, we were doing it like I used to use gouache.
Yeah.
And gouache was like kind of a preferred medium because it dried fast.
I had
acrylic gouache you could actually wipe off. Like if you talk about making a mistake. If you're doing a painting on a board, not on paper it would be harder, but on a board and you didn't like the tones that you put down, you could just put water on your brush and cover it and then blot it off
and
start over once it dried.
I never did that.
Yeah, that's how they used to have to do corrections on art.
We used to use gouache when you did ad agency stuff.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. That's where I learned to do it. I remember one of the first things I remember illustrating at this place, at this ad place in the late 70s, was a bottle of cold beer with this little drips of the condensation on the beer. And that was stuff you did with gouache.
You know, when I took classes, the advertising classes, the guys all worked in New York, and we all had to use gouache.
Well, when I did the cover, the first full-color thing I got to do for DC was, I'm pretty sure it was the first one, was the cover for the Earth Stealers, Superman the Earth Stealers.
Oh, yeah, I remember.
And that was done with acrylic.
Yeah.
And it was really a painful experience because I kept having a hard time. I mean, my original layout was the one I really wanted to do, and the one they chose was not necessarily what I was. So you're always fighting it because it's like, well, that one wasn't as good of a figure as the layout one. So I was struggling, and it was one of those things I had to do over a weekend.
Oh no!
But I did it in acrylics, and I wasn't thrilled with the way it reproduced.
Yeah.
So I think when I did the, I wound up doing the Superman. Or no, I did the Golden Age. Was probably the Superman 424 was undone the blue line where you did the line art separate, and the color was on a board, and the line art was like an overlay, so that the black could be printed as a solid.
Yeah,
black.
They do that.
And that was done with gouache.
Yeah.
So I did that with gouache because I was more comfortable using gouache. Then I did Golden Age hardcover. It was like the greatest stories of the Golden Age. With a whole bunch of characters.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of those hardcovers DC did in like 87, 88. It's probably 88.
Yeah, I remember. And, it's been 30-something years now.
That one was a fun one, but that one also, I used gouache. So that carried over to when I did the Shazam stuff. I was working in the Dr. Martin's Dyes.
Yeah.
And if I needed a good flat background, I would do it in gouache. Did those reproduce
as much faithful to the original?
Yeah, those came out pretty close. The covers,
you do know, I tell people all the time, I say, well, it's on press. The book that you're reading might not have the same color because it shifts.
Depending on the ink.
The magenta, the yellows, they gain and lose.
Right.
So they're never the same.
Right. The worst things, and again, I'm glad I learned it early, like Dr. Martin's Dyes, for example, had fluorescent or like bright colors.
Yep.
There was a fluorescent yellow, a fluorescent pinkish color,
yeah,
and you were back in the days when I worked in commercial art, the guys would always say, those look great,
but don't they ever don't reproduce, use them. No.
Because the fluorescent yellow, for example, prints green.
Yep.
And the other one would print like weirdly brown or something. So you always had to try to stay with primary, not too tricky, and then layer.
Which is funny that you say that, because today, as I'm talking to you, I'm not with Spencer Beck, who's actually visiting John Romita Sr. as we speak.
Oh, that's today?
That's today. I'm going next week to see Terry Austin and Jim Starlin at their house. But anyway, the reason why I mention it is because when I got my first job doing a catalog, the art director got fired. I was 23 years old. I was his assistant. He got fired that day. He gave us notice, but he wanted to wait 6 months.
Right.
And the CEO said, oh, no, I'll make it quicker for you. Get your shit. Get out. You're done.
Right.
So he fired him that day. And I'm sitting in the room going, well, they're going to bring somebody else in. And then they look at me. They go, you've been doing all the work here for 6 months, right? I go, yeah. They go, you're in charge now. And that's it's just like, you know, field promotion. You just, the guy got shot.
Right. So you're I'm the like, guy who's
And they go, you got some ideas? I go, yeah. They go, what do you want to do? And I go, oh, can I make the next cover look like a comic book? They go, do whatever the hell you want. So I said, oh, great. So I sold them on that idea, and I gave them a sketch, and they go, okay, go ahead, make it. I had no idea how to make it, and I bought Pocket Pal. Pocket Pal is that book, the little brown paperback book that explained all the processes, like relief in Italio, how to do letterpress, all the printing stuff.
Okay.
And it said four color separations, like CYMK.
So you had to do them on overlays?
I don't know how to. Because I was used to Ruby Lith and all that. You'd shoot the four plates and they'd put them together for newspaper ads.
Right. But you would have to do a different Ruby Lith for each grade of red
for a comic
or whatever.
Book. Yeah. So I didn't know how to do that.
Yeah.
So I knew how to draw it. So I panicked.
They used Zip-A-Tone with the Ruby Lith or black.
Yeah. I called Marvel up and I talked to the secretary and explained my sad story. And how I was getting married. No, it wasn't. I was engaged. I don't know. But anyway, I said, I need the money, and I can't get fired. So she goes, let me put you on hold. So John Romita was the art director in the 80s and the head of the whole arts department.
Yeah, yeah.
And he picked up the phone, and he goes, what's going on? The secretary says, you're like in tears. I go, here's what happened. Oh, by the way, I'm a huge fan. Blah, 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 blah. And I tell him, he goes, okay, got a pen and paper? I said, yeah. He goes, all right, sit down. We're going to go through for 45 minutes.
Yeah.
I remember looking at the clock. It was from 2 to 2:45. Right. He went through it. The whole process. He goes, first you draw this, then you ink it, then you're going to color. You get your Dr. Martin. So I had to go to the store, Koenig Art Emporium, which I worked at before, so I'd steal stuff. So I got all my dyes, and then I painted them and stuff, and then we did the whole thing. But it was, but I remember they were so bright.
So you had to code it
I had to code it, but I remember telling the printer, this is what it was supposed to look like, because I gave them the overlays, and they look, they go, what is that? And I tell them the number, and they go, oh, that's 30% yellow, 20% magenta.
Well, this is how the charts that we had.
Guys knew?
When I used to color, I started coloring the covers officially. I used to always do with design markers on a big full-size tracing paper.
Right.
I would color my covers, send them in that way so that the...
They had some guide.
And the colorist sometimes followed it and sometimes didn't.
Yeah.
So when I finally got to do it myself, it was because of a cover I did.
Anyway, you were saying that you'd send the guy in with the overlay?
I used to do the overlays and just marker color, like if I had a specific thing.
Yeah.
And then I did this one cover for Adventures of Superman. It's a close-up of Superman crushing a gun.
Yeah.
And it was done for a fill-in issue. That was when I was moving from Wisconsin to Connecticut. Anyways, I did this color guide, and it's got a Wally Wood kind of a split lighting effect on it. Very specific, you know, like a kind of a green highlight on one side to make it... Green is always menacing on a Superman cover.
Yeah, yeah. It's like kryptonite.
The printed cover came out. It looked really bad.
Yeah,
because basically they put the highlight on the wrong side and they put the shadow...
So it's a negative what you thought.
Yeah, it's the opposite and it just looks really dark.
Yeah, yeah.
So I got mad. And John Beatty, who was a friend of mine, John might have been inking me at the time. And John said, you should color him yourself.
Oh,
and
that's like, how you start doing it.
Yeah. He goes, Orchestra, you just got to do it yourself.
Yeah.
So I call up Carl and I said, I want to color him.
Yeah.
And it was a big deal.
Yeah, because that's wanna, his job.
Right.
Yeah.
They also don't want to throw you off your regular deadlines
by giving
you more work.
You're doing this stuff, yeah.
So once I started doing that, they sent me a chart.
Yep.
And you basically would color with your, you know, again, with the Dr. Martens.
Yep.
You weren't allowed to, you were allowed to do like two blends per cover. So you had to make them count.
Yeah.
So you couldn't airbrush everything. There was only you're only allowed like So you'd use them for a big red area, yellow, like if there was, yeah, but if you had like a large area where the you wanted your deep sky blue to fade down to pink or something, that's where you'd use it. And then otherwise you would just put color and then you draw a pencil line to show a shadow.
Yeah.
You draw that pencil line to delineate where that shadow was, and then you would coat it with a slightly darker flesh tone. Flesh tone with like a little bit more blue in it. But it would be like, seriously, like you're looking at like 20% or 10% red, 5% yellow.
I got the breakdowns,
10% blue would be like a good...
Oh, it was complicated, let me tell you.
But it wasn't.
It is if you're looking at it from outside. Yeah,
I'm just saying,
like,
once you figure it out, because those were then taken by, I guess they had housewives working for like page rates.
The colors?
In Bridgeport. That was the chemical color.
McAdams.
And they would take and cut Zippitones at 20%, 30%, whatever. You had a maximum, I think, of like, because of the old printing, the dots would close in.
It was 72?
So you couldn't really do, you couldn't do more than a 50% gray.
90? I'm trying to remember what the screen was for a newspaper. Was it 90? It was really low.
It was pretty low.
Yeah.
So, but it would, again, it would spread on the newsprint. The ink would spread. So
DPI, kind of that's color, what everyone does now. If they don't, 72 DPI, dots per inch. That's how many dots the ink would go through.
Right. So you couldn't do, like if you were creating a flesh tone, you couldn't do too dense of a dot screen.
Red, you know, because it would make the whole thing red. Yeah.
So basically you were limited only in that way. You could still do color combos of red, yellow, and blue.
Say it.
You know, you could get those three to create a dark brown
or
a deep purple or whatever, depending on just toggling the red or blue.
That's why my kids were amazed when they were little. And I used to paint these big murals for the school. And all I had was red, yellow, and blue and black. And they were like, what are you doing? And I would make these things. And they had like the colors of the rainbow. And they would sit there all day long and go, how the hell did you get the yellow, red, blue? I go, you just have to know what to mix, and they're like, what?
But you learned that in school.
I learned that in school.
Yeah, we had to make a color wheel.
Oh yeah, that's what I did too. And you only gave us the basics, and you had to go.
So you had complementary colors, split complements. It was stuff that worked well.
Yeah.
And that's what most colors.
I don't know if they teach any of that anymore.
I hope so, but I mean, the thing I always liked, for me, my favorite color
complements. Yeah.
Favorite color combo was
purple and green.
No.
But
it was like a yellow orange and
red
purple.
Really?
Yeah. It's like a yellow orange and a purple.
The Easter colors,
were like some kind of split complement or some whatever. I forget what the technical.
It's sad that I would always affiliate stuff with religious stuff. I'd go, oh yeah, that's Easter.
No,
that's
I would
Easter.
Think of it because it was like the yellow. I always like warm colors sun because it's a sunlight thing. It's like a paint, like in a painter. Maxfield Parrish used to use those good balances. So the blues and the purples were good shadow colors, rather than using gray for, you know what I mean? Now you can use gray as a shadow color, but I always like taking a flesh color to a purple rather than a flesh color to a gray with a flesh color. It's just cleaner, and the Hildebrandt brothers, when they did their paintings, their painting palette was pretty much exactly what I loved.
Yeah, it was always
because the flesh colors. Would go, the shadow parts would be purples and blues.
Yeah.
It was perfect. And was like very, like a learning experience to get those, the Hobbit calendars and Lord of the Rings calendars and stuff. That was a color education for me.
I still do that
with these markers. That's what I was saying. Like when I was doing the Green Lantern one that I put up on eBay, there's your flesh tone. Mm. It's the lighter version. And then the shadow version, I use purple, like a pale purple. Because aesthetically...
No, I started noticing that too when I start doing shadows, like on red. Instead of getting gray, I'll just get a different, like a light purple.
Yeah.
And it makes it... It still has red coming through.
And that's...
But it looks more realistic.
See, the funny thing is that's what comics did. So you're looking at it, and maybe that affected your aesthetics. Because you're used to seeing it on comic book pages.
That's like gray.
When I started in commercial art, I was low rung. I started and I basically learned and worked my way up. And all I knew was comics.
Yeah.
And all I knew was comic coloring. I had no sense of any kind of color. And these guys I worked with would just beat it into me that gray was not a color.
A real color. It's black, actually.
Yeah.
It's
and
a screen
and
of black.
The trick was to keep your idea of how those three, your three color choices would mix.
Yeah.
Black didn't exist technically. Black should be the combination of all three.
Right.
It was just interesting, and that does change your approach. But it also, it made me appreciate, when I saw it, how people use color for warm and cool, you know, to contrast shadow versus sun or, you know, highlight.
Oh, there's some guys that are great at it. Like, I see some stuff, it's in color. Remember that Olaf guy? Was it Steve Olaf? He's the first one that did the computer color.
And he did
color.
The Batman, right, the Batman movie comic.
Oh, for you? Oh, yeah.
Specifically, like, he was our number one.
I saw that the other day. I can't believe, with all that reaction... For you said, why don't they do a 30th anniversary 100,000. IDW? Why don't they reissue the Batman for the? I was like, that's a great idea. And you have all the things, and everybody. I started looking at all the names. We were like, I bought copies of this. This is what I used to, and all these big name artists that are working out. It's like that was my go to for your cape design and stuff.
But then it says IDW said DC canceled the program. The last one coming out is the Jim Lee one.
Oh, really? Because you told me that.
From DC.
I'm like, when did they do that? Because that would have been a perfect tie-in. I was hoping to sell it at Terrificon. I go, that would be great because we have all those guys coming from the show.
No, it's unfortunate, but, I mean, maybe DC...
I said, you know what? Bring them to the show. We'll do big blow-ups of them. And we'll do, like, an art exhibit. You could do panels because you have them all. I've got the producer coming. I've got two of the actors coming. I'm trying to get three. Actors, we do a whole. Cool. We're showing the movie.
Well, we should pick the pages with Batwing. The actors in them.
I'm making a Batwing.
Find the pictures with the actors in them. Find the pages. Who's coming?
Billy Dee Williams, Robert Wall, Michael Uslan, the producer, and then I'm trying to. I might get Kim Basinger.
That would be interesting.
And then, that would be interesting.
Then you get Alec.
I'm
Baldwin.
Trying to get Tracy Walter too.
Get Alec Baldwin and get them together again.
The number one guy, Bob the Goon. Don't know where he is. If anybody's listening and knows where Bob the Goon is, please call
right now.
I'm trying to track
him
down.
Bob the Goon is like, missing.
He hasn't worked. He was in that Conan the Destroyer movie. Yeah. He was in a couple movies in the 80s. He was
people
a good friend. He
retire.
Disappeared. I know. Wasn't a young man back then.
No, but people just get tired.
Sadly, a lot of the people are dead in that movie. Like, I go look at the cast list. What's the commissioner? Pat Hingle?
Pat Hingle's dead.
Dead.
Michael dead.
Go, who played Alfred.
Right.
Dead. Jack Palance, dead.
Yep.
Who's the other? There's another big name. Well, William Hookins was a side character. He played Eckhart. He's dead. But yeah, a lot of the Batman cast.
Well, there's a case. That one actually, I did the paint. When I painted the cover
by
of the Batman
way,
book, by the
ahead.
Way.
Yes.
That one is done in acrylics. And it was done in acrylics for.
You still have that?
Yeah. It's up hanging in my studio.
Oh, there you go.
But that painting was done in acrylics for no other reason than I just. Decided it was going to be done in acrylics because I knew it had to be layered.
Yeah.
And acrylics is good for layering.
Yeah. Yeah. What you call it? I was thinking, I was talking to Robert Wool, who calls me on Sunday. He played Alexander Knox, the reporter for the Gotham Gazette, which is trying to find out who Batman is. And he called me for the first time on Sunday, and I'm at the deli counter buying lunch meat. But I see the number come up.
Right.
So I pick up, and I told him to call me between Monday through Friday, 10 to 5 Eastern Time, I'm around. Of course, it's Sunday at noon.
But you're still happy to hear.
But I'm still, fine. So I took the call. And it's like, hello. And immediately, my voice, I don't mean to do it, but I do it when I talk to people that have accents.
Oh,
I start to mimic them subconsciously. And, hello, can I talk to Jerry Ordway? This is Robert Wool. So... What you do is you start to talk like Robert Wool and hello legs, you know, and everything's got that. I don't know what it is, but it's, and I'm doing it as I'm talking to him. He's like, oh yeah, the comics are big, you know. You think there'll be a lot of Arliss fans? I go, what? Oh, that show? No, I don't know. Maybe I was in Bull Durham, you know, Robin Williams.
Bull Durham's on. Bull, I think it's on Showtime.
Good Morning America.
Not
Good Morning.
It's on Showtime this month, though.
Good Morning Vietnam.
I actually wanted to see it. I haven't seen it in years.
Good Burger. Really? I used to write jokes for Rodney, and I'm doing the voice right
he
now.
Did
and
jokes is, for the
he
Academy
wrote for the Academy Awards
right,
for Billy Crystal.
Crystal.
Yeah,
right.
He's. I'm good friends with him. People. Tell me about this comic book culture. It was really funny. So I'm in the car for an hour. So I left the grocery store. I said, look, I can't talk to you unless you want to hear me order my turkey breast. He goes, is it fresh turkey? I go, "It's you can kill your own turkey. He goes, what do you mean? I said, they go in the back room with an axe. It's like two men enter. It's like Thunderdome, but it's with turkeys. He goes, really? Things are crazy in Connecticut. So I said, yeah. So I said, you know, you go in, hopefully you're the victor, and you come out with fresh turkey breast. And he goes, oh, okay. So
you're
I said to him, does this happen to you? What? I said, as a comedian, do people try to be funnier than you? He goes, yeah. I said, it's like a big guy going into a bar and everybody wants to pick a fight with him. Like, I could take him. Oh, I'm bigger than that guy. Let's go, buddy. I'll do the arm wrestling with you right now. So he goes, yeah. I said, do you mind that? He goes, no, if they're funny, it's okay. But if they're not, I said, how am I doing so far? He goes, why don't you call me back? I was like, all right. Alexander Knox. I said, I've got your action figure. He goes, they made an action figure? I go, no, they did. No kid wants to play with the reporter. What do you got? I've got Batman. Who do you got? I've got the Joker. Who do you got? I've got the investigative reporter.
The president has reporter action figures the that kid, that's the breaks kid the arms off of.
Even Pat Hingle missing his finger would have been a better one. Go! You ever notice he's missing a finger?
No.
You didn't know that?
No.
Pat Hingle is missing his ring finger on his left hand. And it only becomes apparent when they're doing the Val Kilmer one.
Okay.
Batman Forever? Yeah, Batman Returns, Batman Forever, and then Batman, yeah.
Right.
So at the very end when he's like, they're on the top of the police station, and they put the bat signal on, and Batman Val Kilmer returns, right. And he's like, go, go! And he's all happy, he's jancing around. Because, of course, the inept police department of the Gotham City can't handle the Riddler, who they know is on an island that's got a big giant question mark. Right. I don't know where he is. He's right there.
Yeah.
So he's chairing, and as he raises his hand, you notice he's missing a finger. I go, wow.
See?
Neither here nor there.
I drew him.
Draw him with the finger?
I probably did. I probably gave him some sort of wish fulfillment by drawing him with a full set of fingers.
So Robert Wool's character, spoiler alert, was supposed to originally die. Well, did you know that? He was supposed to get killed. And then I told him, well, do you know about the subplot where they thought you were Batman? He didn't know what I was talking about, and I knew about it from your comic book.
And that was in
the adaptation.
The script, though, but that was
he did not know about
that. Was in the screenplay, and we always wondered whether they filmed it or not.
They did one scene where, at the very end, after the Joker's running amok amongst the Gotham parade, the 200 parade, Alexander Knox is unconscious in the alleyway because he gets almost hit by a car driven by Kim Basinger.
Right.
So Batman took off his costume and left it on his unconscious body?
That's two different things because he goes in the car with her, I thought, in the movie.
All I know is they find him knocked out with the costume on and they go, he must be Batman.
It was the way of allowing him to escape because...
You mean
the entire
Bruce Wayne?
The entire town, I mean, Gotham.
Everybody's watching.
Everybody's watching the cathedral. The Joker just falls.
And they're hanging on a rope.
Right. So how does Batman get away?
Oh, so that was how he got out?
It was basically within the original script. I'm 100% sure it was in the original script.
Yeah. There's a scene filmed.
Helps them by covering him with the cape. And then we did in the comic, we actually added the shot of Bruce Wayne with the costume without the cape sneaking off to the side because we were
A still I found and I sent to Robert Wall of him lying unconscious in an alleyway
with the
cape and cowl on. It's on his body and Commissioner Gordon finds him.
So they did film it.
They did.
Okay, but that's a different scene.
I thought that was the end.
That was from the end. But that wasn't the same. In other words, there was a scene in the parade at the end of the parade where he gets falls into a bunch of boxes.
Right, right. That's what this was.
This scene happens at the end after the Joker falls out the cathedral.
And you got it from a script? Danny O'Neill read that from the script?
Well, we had the copy of the script. We had the shooting script, but they kept changing stuff.
Well, when he told me his character originally died, and then they said, oh, no, Tim Burton liked him. He said, oh, no, keep him alive. He said he flew to England to film, but he thought he was going to be dead, and then on the spot...
Yeah.
They changed
it. And isn't
it
a shame that he didn't get to return for the
Well, that's
next
what
movie.
He said to me on the phone. He goes, they kept me alive, and he
Billy
thought
D.
he'd
Williams.
Be back, and he didn't...
It was worse for Billy D. Williams, because he's...
They had
he's
promised him to be Harvey Dent.
But he's introduced as Harvey Dent.
Yeah, Two-Face.
So everybody knows, Two-Face.
And he was a good-looking guy, so I assumed that's why they got him, because he was handsome.
Instead, we get
Tommy Lee Jones
chewing scenery.
A production of Big Fedora Marketing LLC, the folks that bring you the terrific Comic-Con, GamerCon, and so much more. Thanks for listening.